Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Advocates of voting rights say we're facing a perilous moment in America. The 2020 election saw the highest voter turnout in more than a century, but ever since, Republican-led state legislatures have been working to make voting more difficult. Just this year, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, at least 19 states have enacted 33 laws that make it harder to vote. In response to that, Democrats in Washington have tried to pass legislation to protect voting rights, but Senate Republicans have blocked those efforts with a filibuster. Even a compromise bill, the Freedom to Vote Act, hammered out by the moderate Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia, failed to win even one Republican vote. Senator Angus King, the independent from Maine, says we're at a hinge of history, a moment when the fate of the American experiment hangs in the balance. We'll hear from King shortly, but first, we're going to start this hour with On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Anthony.
So, this feels like a bit of an impasse on the efforts to pass major voting rights legislation in Washington. What are the consequences of that, in your view? Where are we right now with this fight?
Well, I think Senator King has and will speak on our program shortly eloquently to the consequences for democracy. But more narrowly, the consequences are dire for the Democratic Party. Consider that in the 2020 election, just 44,000 votes in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin, and Biden and Trump would have been tied in the Electoral College. The vote, the decision then under the contingent election provision of the 12th Amendment would have gone to the House, and each and suddenly, California and Wyoming would be equal because each delegation gets one vote. Republicans have more delegations. They would have elected Donald Trump legally, procedurally in the House of Representatives if just 44,000 votes in those three states had shifted. Now, what has happened is in two of those states, Georgia and Arizona, they've already passed restrictive voting measures. We're going to hear about Georgia. And Wisconsin's legislature, Republican legislature, passed a restrictive bill comprehensively limiting voting rights that was vetoed by the Democratic governor. That governor may not be there after 2022. So essentially, if the Democrats allow these restrictions to go into effect, and if Wisconsin tilts to the Republicans in 2022, they will have essentially set up a situation where all the Republicans have to do is reduce the vote marginally in each of these states, and they have a tie in the Electoral College. The Democrats can't let that stand and still profess to be a viable political party. Their answer to it is to somehow have a carve-out under the filibuster that would allow that essentially would allow these voting rights acts to go through. But President Biden doesn't really seem to be on top of that. Last week, talking to CNN, he said, well, we need the talking filibuster immediately. Well, election experts point out that's no answer at all, because essentially it would tie up all congressional business. There's no nothing would prevent the Republicans from just teaming it up, you know, going around the clock with one person succeeding another. And essentially, you'd be swapping a proposal that would delay one piece of legislation. It would stop one piece of legislation. You'd delay all legislation. So it's as if the president hadn't really thought through this crucial issue. All of this casts a pall over the upcoming election for the Democrats, and basically says unless they can find a way through to get the Freedom to Vote Act passed, they are going to acquiesce in a situation that imperils their prospects to be Biden's prospects to be reelected?
Well, as we said, as Democrats have been pushing for federal voting rights legislation, they're doing that to counteract a wave of new restrictions from Republican-led state legislatures. And I want to zero in specifically on Georgia. Georgia's new election law, Republican-controlled legislature there approved it, and Governor Brian Kemp signed that into law. And joining us now to talk about that is Tia Mitchell. She's a Washington correspondent at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And Tia, it's good to have you.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk about this Georgia voting law. What does it do? Give us a sense of how it expands early voting and other stuff, other provisions that actually restrict voting. How do you assess what it does?
So it does a lot. I will say the one part that Republicans have pointed to say, look, we've expanded voting is when it comes to early voting, because the law standardizes early voting. And so in states that perhaps had a more restrictive early voting period, it now requires them to have certain things like 2 weeks of early voting before a general election and early voting on the weekend. But what Republicans don't say is by standardizing early voting, they limited early voting in areas that had more than the standard going ahead of the law. So particularly in Metro Atlanta, the state's most populous counties had more early voting, and now that will be limited by the law. In addition, the law does certain things like requiring new identification requirements for requesting an absentee ballot. It restricts the use of drop-off boxes that we know were widely used during the coronavirus pandemic in the 2020 election. So you can't drop boxes will no longer be 24 hours. So that takes away a little bit of the convenience of drop boxes. It also had limitations on passing out food and water to people waiting in line. That's something that, you know, has got a lot of attention. And Republicans will say, well, there's just a radius. You can pass out people, you know, waiting for food and water if they're far away from the precinct, or the precinct workers can give them water. You just can't come off the street and give people food and water. But again, you know, Democrats say that's still limiting helping people who may be standing in a long line. So there are so many things that Republicans put into the bill. And as you noted, what Republicans say is about making it safer. But Democrats say on the margins, these little tweaks can have an influence on a close race.
Right. Well, Tia, I want to just hear from Governor Brian Kemp. He signed the bill into law. And right after he did this, here's what he said about the law.
And contrary to the hyper-partisan rhetoric you may have heard inside and outside this gold dome, the facts are that this new law will expand voting access in the Peach State.
So there's Governor Brian Kemp saying that this new voting law will expand it. Republicans have also said this is all about the integrity of the ballot. Tia, how did they make that case in Georgia when they were debating this bill?
Well, you know, there are some Republicans who were allies of Donald Trump that literally repeated a lot of the misinformation or false information that alleged that there was widespread fraud in Georgia's election. There were hearings led by Senate Republicans that featured Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani in Georgia. And, you know, he spread, you know, really lies about the election, lies about, you know, poll workers and suitcases of ballots that were not properly counted, that none of that was true. But that is a lot of the so-called evidence, or even there are many Republicans who would say, well, people raised so many questions and had so many concerns, and there's so much distrust around the election. We need these laws to improve confidence. But what they don't admit is their own party leader, President Trump and his allies, they actively worked to shake the confidence of voters through lies, and then Republicans use that shaken confidence to then justify these new laws.
Mm. Now, Tia, let's remind listeners that Joe Biden carried Georgia in 2020 by just a little more than 12,000 votes, if I have that right. So are Democrats concerned that this new law could actually tip Georgia back towards Republicans in 2024?
Yes, and we should note, not only did Biden win, but it was recounted three different times, including one that in certain ways was a hand count, a hand recount. So Biden's win was confirmed multiple times in Georgia. But yes, Democrats are concerned that, again, it's just little changes because Georgia's margins are expected to be so close going into 2022, where we have a Senate race and a governor's race and many statewide races on the ballot, that even just small ways to affect voters, particularly voters of color, voters who maybe are your less frequent voters who are easily intimidated at the polls, more apt to give up if there are barriers in their way and voting isn't as easy as possible. That's where Democrats worry that, you know, these changes could affect turnout, cause some ballots to be thrown out, because there are laws, for example, saying if you don't vote in the correct precinct, you don't automatically get a provisional ballot that's counted. You're supposed to go to your right precinct. But what if you show up at the wrong precinct just a few minutes before the precincts close?
Tia,
you know, those type of things.
We're moving up against a break, but I want to ask you one last question before I let you go. We heard Jack talking about how Democrats' efforts to pass major voting rights legislation in Washington is essentially stalled. Is there a path forward for any federal voting rights legislation, in your view?
Without a change to the filibuster, my view is that, no, there is not a path forward. And there is no clear mandate from all 50 members of the Democratic caucus that they will approve a change to the filibuster.
All right. Well, that's Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia Mitchell, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, stand by. We've got a lot more to come. Coming up after the break, we're going to be hearing from Senator Angus King of Maine, who spoke recently on the Senate floor about his concerns about what's happening with voting rights and about what's happening with this fragile democracy of ours. Stay with us. That's just ahead on Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking this hour about Republican efforts to tighten voting rules across the country. Advocates for voting rights are concerned that they're making it a lot harder for folks to vote. And we're also talking about efforts at the federal level to pass major voting rights legislation. With me is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. And Jack, we heard from Tia Mitchell, who really laid out what happened in Georgia and efforts in Washington. And I'd love to just ask you to comment about what you heard. Specifically, I was struck by what Tia said, how in Georgia, former President Trump's unfounded claims about election fraud really fueled the effort in Georgia to pass this law.
Yes. I mean, these are real world consequences from his fictional lying claims about that election, because, as Tia said, it was validated even by a mostly hand count three different times. Yes, this is perhaps one of the most poisoned fruits resulting from that poisonous lie. And as she says, the Democrats, the Freedom to Vote Act would retroactively eliminate and strike down some of these provisions, not all of them, but it would at least make it a fairer chance for the Democrats. But standing in the way is the filibuster, and standing and guarding the filibuster within the Democratic camp are Senators Manchin and Sinema. And Joe Biden mentioned last week a third senator. Maybe we can find out who that is from Senator King.
Hmm. Well, earlier this month, U.S. Senator Angus King, he's an independent from Maine, spoke on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He said, "We are at a hinge of history, in a moment when the fate of the American experiment hangs in the balance." And he was talking about the importance of protecting voting rights against state efforts to roll back voting rights and against false claims of voter fraud and a stolen presidential election. And Senator King joins us now. Welcome to On Point. It's good to have you, Senator.
Anthony, good to be with you.
So let me just start right off with a quick question about process. Are efforts to pass major voting rights legislation in Washington dead?
No, I don't think so. There are just all kinds of discussions going on right now, today, over the next several days, to find a path forward. As you mentioned, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are very reluctant about changing the filibuster. I've been reluctant about changing the filibuster because once it goes away, it's gone, and it's not available as a defensive measure if the shoe is on the other foot in terms of the partisan makeup of the Senate 2, 4, or 6 years from now. So it's not an easy decision, but I've come to the conclusion it's a decision we have to confront when it comes to voting rights, which is the fundamental beating heart of our democracy.
So when you say it's a decision you have to confront, you're talking about a possible carve-out in the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation just with all 50 Democrats and two independents, you and Bernie Sanders, right?
Well, that's one option, is a carve-out. There are other options being talked about altering the rule without abolishing it, to make it harder to just plain obstruct. I mean, the theory, the justification for the filibuster is that it allows the minority to have a role in legislation, to be involved, to improve bipartisanship, to force compromise. The problem is that theory breaks down when the minority says we're not going to talk, we're not going to negotiate, we're not going to contribute, we're just going to block. And that's where we are right now. So that's why there are so many discussions. Carve out is a possibility. But again, you do a carve out for voting rights, the Republicans take over and they do a carve out for right to life or some other issue that's of importance to millions of people across the country. So we're trying to find a path that doesn't totally scrap what may be a very useful tool in the future, but will enable us to move forward on this critical issue. I want to pull the focus back, and maybe you want to follow up, but we're talking about the preservation of democracy in this country. Mm-hmm. Democracy is an anomaly in world history. The norm in world history are dictators, czars, pharaohs, and now they call them presidents for life. But that's the norm, and we've seen in our lifetimes 3 or 4 countries – Venezuela, Russia, Hungary, Turkey, and now I think Brazil, that have slid from democracy to a really authoritarianism, and it can happen here. We think it's, you know, we're safe and it'll never happen here because of our Constitution. We had a near miss last winter, a really near miss, and now folks are gearing up to change the rules in such a way that you're not going to be able to have free and fair elections that involve all the people in the country. I always thought the idea was maximum turnout, not not limit turnout.
Right.
And what's being discussed right now is really dangerous. Here's the problem as I see it. We've already got a third of the country that doesn't trust elections because, as you were just commenting, the former president and his supporters have been saying for months that the election was rigged, and a third of the country believes that. It's not true. There's no objective evidence. All the evidence is in the other direction. But there we are. So, okay, they pass these restrictive rules. They also are talking in states about passing rules that allow the state legislature to override the preference expressed by the voters in that state in a presidential election and send their own electors to Congress. If that happens, then you've got a whole hell of a lot of Democrats and independents who don't trust elections. Then we're really in a bad place. Because
right.
if we don't have trust in elections, how do we make these decisions? And you end up with a kind of, you know, raw power is all that matters. And the peaceful transfer of power, as I said on the floor the other night, becomes a distant memory.
No, and I'm glad you transitioned to what you talked about on the Senate floor the other day, because that's what I wanted to talk to you about. And you really got to the heart of it. You suggested that at least some of these efforts that we're seeing, and I assume you're talking about efforts in Republican-led legislatures across the country, are nothing more than stone-cold partisan voter suppression. Which measures are most troubling to you? Maybe you already articulated it. Is it the ones that give that kind of sort of overall authority to state legislatures to just overcome the will of the voters?
I think that in some ways is the most dangerous for two reasons. One, because it would totally subvert the whole idea of popular sovereignty. And secondly, it would undermine confidence on another substantial portion of the population. And then, as I say, it'll end up with raw power, and I just worry about where that leads. It did lead to violence on January 6th and death threats. So you had a hearing just yesterday in the Rules Committee about, you know, nonpartisan voting officials around the country getting death threats. And people, you know, sending them letters. We know your kids' names. We know where you live. And, that's the end of democracy when we're in that situation. What am I worried about? Well, Tia mentioned a number of the provisions in Georgia, and there's a lot around the country. And a lot of them look sort of neutral on the face of it. For example, in Texas, they may say only one drop box per county. Okay, one drop box per county. Well, the problem is the county where Houston is has 4 million people. One drop box in that county is just not going to be very helpful to people having access and being able to vote. Another one that I heard about yesterday, apparently in Georgia, they're saying people can't register to vote during the period of a runoff for the U.S. Senate. In Georgia, if no candidate gets 50% in the general election, they have a runoff. And I think they've shortened that period. This is where Warnock won his election, Warnock and Ossoff in the runoffs. And nobody that registered during that period is going to be still registered. So that's the kind of thing. And as your commentator was saying, it doesn't take a lot here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about pretty narrow.
Yeah, just a few tens of thousands of votes. Yeah, right.
Yeah, pretty narrow margin. So, and again, this whole thing, I mean, it's a classic bootstrap. There's no evidence of fraud. There's no demonstration of fraud. The president and his supporters brought 60 lawsuits. They were all dismissed. And yet, by saying, well, people are worried about fraud, therefore we got to make these changes, it's a pretext.
Mm-hmm. Senator, let me just get you to respond to this. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He was speaking on the Senate floor this past June before a procedural vote on Senate Bill 1, the so-called For the People Act. McConnell called it one of the left's most radical priorities. He also defended Georgia's new election law. Here's what he said.
Remember, the last presidential election saw the highest voter turnout in decades. But when Georgia passed targeted updates to its election laws based on lessons learned during the pandemic-era elections, Democrats trashed the bill as, quote, a redux of Jim Crow. They misrepresented its content so wildly that even left-leaning fact checks repeatedly debunked these claims.
So, Senator, that's Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. And let me just read you a couple of maybe three comments from Facebook from our listeners. Josh McKay writes, In 2020, it was made clear that the voting system would be temporarily altered to accommodate voters during the pandemic. Now that things are improving, those voting laws are being returned to normal. It's not restricting anyone from voting. And here's another listener, Bill Schaefer. It's totally within the jurisdiction of the states, and they aren't making it harder to vote. They're making it harder to cheat. And one more. Frank Sullivan, voting in the U.S. worked for a couple of hundred years. Everything is now considered restricting. Time, date, registering, even voting at a designated polling place is now a restriction. Finally, Ray Russell, there is nothing wrong with secure voting. I live in Virginia. It's easy to vote as long as you identify yourself. So interestingly, that's the sort of the overwhelming tone of the comments we're getting on Facebook. How do you respond to those concerns? Go ahead, sir.
First, let me take the one that said it's absolutely clear that this is a state responsibility. Interestingly, that's just flat out not true. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, does say the manner and timing of election, or the manner of election, shall be determined by the state legislature, semicolon, but the Congress by law may alter or amend such regulations. In other words, it shares the responsibility and makes abundantly clear that Congress clearly has the not only the power, but the ability to go forward and what we're talking about here is not a federal takeover of state elections. It's trying to set a minimum standard, a floor, if you will, to be sure that election laws are not being manipulated in order to keep people from voting. In Maine, we have no voter ID. We have same-day registration. We have no excuse absentee voting. We have early voting, and we have no fraud. The question that should be asked of these folks is, why do we need these changes? That's the question. When I used to deal with the Maine legislature, when I was governor, when I was a citizen, the chairman of the committee would always say, what's the problem we're trying to solve here?
Right.
And they have no answer to that except this vague thing about we're trying to make elections more secure. The problem is there's no evidence that they're not secure.
Right.
And they're solving a non-problem. And, oh, by the way, we may have longer lines in black precincts in Atlanta than we do in the suburbs. But, you know, that's really not voting restrictions. Yes, it is. And particularly when you're talking about you're talking about the kinds of small margins that we're talking about here. So the first question to ask is, why are they doing this? There isn't any real fraud to be remedied. And we had the Secretary of State of Kentucky yesterday, a Republican. I asked him point blank, any fraud in Kentucky? He mentioned one case, and he said occasionally there are cases in a small community, but the kind of widespread voter fraud that the former president's been talking about just doesn't exist.
Jack Beatty, I know you've been listening along, and you've got a question or two for Senator King.
Yes, Senator. Last week, I mentioned Joe Biden said there were three senators who would give him, whose fealty to the filibuster made it difficult for him to pressure them right now until he gets the vote on his reconciliation package. Do you know who that third senator is?
Nope. I don't. I'm sorry. I'm not being coy.
Okay.
I really don't.
Okay.
I mean, as I say, I've always expressed reluctance about it. But I made it clear in an op-ed in the Washington Post about 6 months ago that I considered voting rights in a special category. That it's different than an ordinary piece of legislation. This is the foundation of our whole system. Government of, by, and for the people. The people.
Yeah. Right. Well, all right. On the question of the filibuster, the Brookings Institution, citing a typically Delphic utterance of Senator Manchin about we could do it under reconciliation, recommends what they call democratic reconciliation as a way to carve out an exception to the filibuster. And basically, they say this would work by attaching the Freedom to Vote Act to a budget bill. The Senate parliamentarian would then rule, no, you can't have a non-budget-related measure in a budget bill. I won't allow that. And then the majority could reject her advice via a vote. Is that Is that at all? It has the framework of the Byrd rule and the reconciliation. As I say, distantly, Joe Biden has made, I mean, Manchin has made a comment about reconciliation. Does that sound like something that could work?
Well, it's one of those options that's being discussed. The problem is you override the parliamentarian's ruling and basically reconciliation, which is a straight majority vote, becomes the rule for everything. The rule now is with reconciliation, it can only deal with budgetary matters, not substantive policy issues. If you breach that, then you've effectively gotten rid of the filibuster. And I, you know, this is a worthwhile discussion about whether the filibuster really makes sense. I did a calculation that you can come up with 41 votes to block anything with senators representing 24% of the American people. Because the Senate is you know, it's biased because of its structure toward more rural, smaller states. Maine, blessedly, has two senators. So does California and New York. But it's pretty hard to justify the control that the minority has under the current rules. Here's a really interesting fact. Under the Articles of Confederation, which was the way the country was run in the 10 years or so between the Revolution and the Constitution, one of the problems that they encountered was it had a supermajority requirement and they couldn't get anything done. So we don't really want to go back to that.
Right. Senator Angus King, independent U.S. Senator from Maine, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate your thoughtfulness and your passion on the Senate floor. Thanks very much.
Great to be with you, Anthony. Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, stand by. In a moment, we're going to be discussing the ways activists of the past and present are fighting and fought for voting rights. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Virginia's gubernatorial election, why it's so important to both political parties, and what it says about where the country's heading. If you're voting in Virginia, we want to hear from you. Who are you voting for? And has your vote changed from when you started thinking about this race? Why? Is there a particular issue that made the difference? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683, and we'll put your story on the air. Let's return to our discussion of voting rights. Throughout their history, again and again, Americans have had to fight for the right to vote. Those Americans include Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons. Simmons was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1944 during the Jim Crow era, when local laws enforced racial segregation in states like hers. She was raised by her grandmother and describes her childhood as a happy one. But then she began to notice that her life was not what she wanted it to be.
You know, it wasn't until I was a teenager that I, you know, started wanting to do things and realizing I can't go to the library. That's crazy. We couldn't go to the art museum. We had one day that we could go to the zoo. So, you know, as you got older and realized all of the things you couldn't do because of the color of your skin. So by the time I was a junior in high school, I was growing very angry.
Simmons attended Spelman College in Atlanta in the early 1960s, and despite her grandmother's wish that she focus on her studies, she started volunteering for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, a national civil rights movement of students. In 1964, Simmons learned about Freedom Summer, which sent 1,000 volunteers to Mississippi to register black Americans to vote. That year, fewer than 7 out of 100 eligible black voters in Mississippi were registered. And Simmons says that's how Mississippi lawmakers wanted it to be.
The laws that were put in place, everything from poll taxes to basically the registrar could ask you to do something as ridiculous as counting the number of jelly beans in a big jar of jelly beans. And that on top of the terror, because often if you attempted to register, your name would be called down to the sheriff and the sheriff would let your employer know. I mean, it was a system, a total system of the denial of the right to vote.
In June of 1964, Simmons went to Freedom Summer orientation in Oxford, Ohio for 2 weeks. While she was there, 3 Freedom Summer activists were murdered by Klansmen in Mississippi. It sent shockwaves through the Freedom Summer organization. Still, Simmons traveled to Laurel, Mississippi, where she joined 2 other freedom riders, going door to door to try to convince people to register to vote.
And I lucked out. The very first house that I went to, the first door that I knocked on, this woman, she looked like she was in her 50s. And I was still trying to figure out, how do you ask somebody to get involved? It's so dangerous. And I was kind of stammering, trying to figure out how to ask her. And she looked me up and down. She knew I wasn't from there. You know, I had an afro and very few people wore afros then. She said, "Are you a freedom rider?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "Come in. I've been waiting on you all my life."
She'd been waiting a long time just to register to vote. But state and local laws made that almost impossible.
Now, we knew we were not going to be able to get people registered. So we were going to hold mock, M-O-C-K, voter registration drives anywhere we could, at churches, at barbershops. And so across the state, thousands of black people registered to vote in the mock elections. The purpose was to show to the Democratic Party and to the nation that black people wanted to register to vote. And we had thousands, you know, who had already filled out forms, they had been notarized. So we had the proof.
Simmons ended up staying in Mississippi for 18 months. She led the Freedom Schools, where she taught black students about African-American history and how the government works, education they weren't getting from the state schools. In 1965, she joined a voting rights protest march in Jackson, the state capital, where she was arrested with about 1,000 other people and detained for 2 weeks.
There was no place to put all of us who were arrested inside their jails. So they put us on the fairgrounds in what were like stockades. So we were put in the buildings that normally would have held the livestock. Then they brought in these men, and I don't think by any stretch of the imagination were they law officials. And they circled us and they began beating us with sticks, billy clubs.
That same year, Simmons' sacrifice appeared to pay off. Congress passed the landmark Voting Rights Act. She says the law, which prohibits discrimination in voting, gets to the core of what it means to be American and to live in a democracy.
The Voting Rights Act, the Federal Voting Rights Act, which sent in federal registrars into the state of Mississippi. They registered, really registered, legally registered thousands of black people. And so that was the beginning of the end of the denial of the right to vote in Mississippi and other places in the South where Black people have been prevented from voting. So the vote is fundamental. It's foundational. We don't have a democracy without it.
Gwendolyn Zahara Simmons was a SNCC program director and a Freedom School teacher. She recently retired from the University of Florida, where she was a professor in the religion department. The 1965 Voting Rights Act prohibited states like Mississippi from changing their election laws without federal approval. In 2013, the Supreme Court gutted that part of the law, ruling that it was no longer necessary and unconstitutional. So how are activists today fighting for voting rights? Latasha Brown is the co-founder of the voting rights group Black Votes Matter, based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and she joins us now. Latasha Brown, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Greetings. Thank you for having me on.
Well, tell me about the goals of your organization, Black Voters Matter, and your goals right now. What are you focused on?
You know, the goals of our organization is to help build power for our community by engaging, creating an engaged electorate to actually help shape the public policy that's impacting our communities. And so ultimately, we do that in a variety of ways, from voter registration, but voter education and mobilization. And so some of the goals now, what we've been in existence for the last 5 years, and part of what we believe that strengthens democracy in a nation that touts itself as a model democracy, when a third of the people are not even interested in the process, and at least in any given election year, 40% of the population don't even bother to vote. And we're saying that in order to have a strong democracy, you're going to have an engaged and informed electorate. And so that's part of the work that we lead at Black Voters Matter Fund. You know, what we're working on right now is essentially really pushing against the voter suppression that we've seen. You know, we're going to have to really think about what is happening right now. We're going to have to call it what it is. We can't create these binaries or these false equivalencies that, okay, the Democrats did this, and so the Republicans' response to that. No, it's much deeper than that. This is really, as I see it, political corruption at its core. Anytime people are participating in the process and there are punitive measures because they've participated, the very definition of that is political corruption. And so what we're seeing is the rise of voting restriction laws that restrict access to the ballot in 48 states around the country, right? Being in my native state of Georgia, that were literally targeted to punish, to be a punitive measure, to punish and to be more, and to marginalize the vote in those areas because people participated in a way that some folks were not happy with the outcome.
So I want to ask you, you mentioned Georgia, and I wanted to ask you about Georgia, and we talked about that earlier in the hour. You worked alongside Stacey Abrams. You helped turn Georgia blue for the first time in 28 years. There was, in the 2020 election, more than 1 million African Americans cast ballots in Georgia. But as you mentioned, it's one of the states where new legislation has been passed. Folks like you think it restricts, make a case that it restricts access to the ballot. So let's start there. What is the law in Georgia? Do you see it as risking turning the progress that you've made there back?
You know, it's kind of like the death by a thousand cuts. I think we have to really look at the spectrum of voter suppression. You know, people will look at, oh, there's voting laws or voting ID laws. Oh, that's not that bad. That's just, okay, that has some impact, but that's a little impact. Then people will look at, you know, the polling site, the massive closure of polling sites that happened after the 2013 Shelby versus Holder election. In addition to that, what you're also seeing is you're seeing a massive kind of coordinated effort to purge voters from the rolls. Just a few weeks ago, the Republican Secretary of State dropped over 100,000 voters from the rolls. In addition to that, you know, now you have these restrictions that are not just only restricting access to the ballot on when you can vote, early voting, what places you have access to. But I think the most egregious part, and Senator Kaine alluded to this in his conversation, that they're weaponizing the administrative process. What we're seeing is a Secretary of State in Georgia right now is calling for the resignation of the head of the election boards in the local counties. And there is an attempt to take over those election boards. So now this administration process, which I think is the most egregious, well, that if you don't like, if the ruling party does not like the outcome, that they will have some authority, even more so than the Secretary of State, to make a different outcome, which was precisely what President Trump was asking for in this last election when he wanted the Secretary of State to just go, quote, find 11,000 votes. You know, we have to really be able to see what is at stake. There's one, while this has been an effort that we know, I think has been, the impetus has been to punish Black voters and other voters, Democratic-leaning voters, in this process. And in some very weird ways, we're going to have to be honest about the role of structural racism, because America seems to have a strong tolerance. We have a lot of tolerance when Black voters are impacted in this country. And so we have to really see it that while, yes, that's one of the outcomes, that it fundamentally undermines and unravels the foundation of democracy whenever a ruling party is able to change the rules because they don't like the outcome. That in itself is the beginning of the death of democracy.
Mm. Meanwhile, LaTosha Brown, we seem to be at an impasse in approving major federal voting rights laws in Washington. How frustrated are you about that? And do you see a path forward in Washington?
You know, I'm extremely frustrated. The fact that we're in 2021, you know, and we are in the year that there was a historic turnout of voters. And now we have to go right back to defend making sure that we're giving access. A strong democracy is not a structure or a system that is restrictive to voters or is punitive to voters. In fact, we should be having conversations how we can expand accessibility. Even in the state of Georgia, in the last election, in the primary of last year in 2020, there were people that stayed in line, that stood in line for more than 11 hours. I and my team actually was at one polling site where the last voter did not vote until 12:37 a.m., you know, which is essentially the next day. I'm raising this because I think we have to really understand there is a fundamental issue in this country around the political and the voting infrastructure. We cannot negotiate the rights of citizens or our democracy literally will be unraveled. We need voting rights legislation right now. And so what we know is with the filibuster has been used historically over the years to actually stand in a way and be a tool against civil rights legislation. We need Joe Biden. We need President Biden. We need him to use the full weight of his office to put pressure on the Senate that we, whether that's a carve out, whether that's the abolition of the filibuster, we cannot in any circumstances allow voters to be punished because how they voted or who they voted for.
Well, LaTosha Brown, co-founder Black Voters Matter, I want to really thank you for joining us today and giving us your perspective. I'm really grateful for it.
Thank you for having me.
And still with us is Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, we've heard a lot of voices in this hour, and I want to just give you a chance to sort of wrap it up for us and give us your thoughts about where we are right now with this effort to respond to restrictions across the country on voting, the impasse in Washington. What do you make of it all?
Well, Ms. Simmons reminds us of the central drama here. It's the drama of American history, the exclusion of African Americans from the polls, the preventing of them voting. That's what's at stake here. You can't miss it when you look at Texas, one drop box for a rural county, one drop box for, you know, Harris County, urban county. You can't miss what that's all about. And we have a president who has been sounding a faint trumpet on the filibuster and on the how central it is to pass this legislation. In last week, he went through. He said we might soon need to change it. He said I'm open to changing it, but he said it remains to be seen what change would look like. It was, as Charles Blow said in the New York Times, a weak need argument. He has to confront the two senators in his party who are preventing the advance of justice in America. That's what this comes down to. Mm. And he's got to tell them, if you keep the filibuster, the relic of a Jim Crow era, you will wear the scarlet R on your chest forever. Mm-hmm. The R of racist.
I'm thinking Angus King's point is sticking with me. A third of all Americans and fully two-thirds of all Republicans believe that the last election was fraudulent. How do we deal with that? How do we change those hearts and minds? Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, thanks for joining us today, as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.